We all breathe the same air. We walk the same ground, drink from common water sources, eat from common food sources. We are all connected in such fundamental ways. It can be startling to look in the mirror at our modern existence and to think about all the man-made instruments that separate us from our natural condition and force disconnections between us. Long commutes, cell phones, big screen televisions, and so on are just some of the impediments that physically divide us now, of course, but my focus here is on rhetorical wedges, or ways in which our words tend to break us apart as communities and as a nation. And also how a renewed focus on the rhetorical concept of audience, that is, finding common ground, can bring us back together. I'm Brett Opegard, a doctoral student at Texas Tech University studying rhetoric as part of Dr. Rich Rice's Theories of Invention class. This podcast will quickly trace ideas related to the concept of audience through modern politics and contemporary rhetoric, back through time to ancient Rome and Greece. This piece will also flow into the classroom context, situations in which information is being filtered and delivered, and it will reflect on what educators as well as students can gain from increasing audience awareness or reaching for common ground and speaking to that well-regarded sweet spot. To situate this recording, it's November 2010, shortly after the second straight national election of change, characterized by perceptions of dramatic shifts in power. Turmoil appears to be everywhere. Our infrastructure seems to be falling apart. Popular success of the right-wing media has spawned a warring left-wing media, creating vocal factions, 24 hours of airtime to fill each day across many channels, creating constant and increasingly vicious rhetorical battles over the news of each day. It's all about how events can be shaped into politics and framed a partisan advantage. It's a period in which agreement and consensus between these factions would be bad for business. America, the land of 300 million immigrants, every one of them a distinct individual, has almost always had cohesion issues, of course, and virtually every presidential candidate who comes along promises to be the bipartisan solution to our fracturing ills, or to work best across the aisle, or to bring us together. This sentiment was a key component of Barack Obama's speech at the Democratic National Convention in 2004. Which helped to elevate him to presidential contender. Channeling Lincoln, we can come together, it seems here, on the idea of coming together.
For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga, a belief that we're all connected as one people. If there's a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer, even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states, red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats, but I've got news for them too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who opposed the war in Iraq, and there are patriots who supported the war in Iraq. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes. All of us defending the United States of America. In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope?
Cynicism or hope? Are we one people, or are we many? I think it's safe to say over the past couple of years, the rhetoric of cynicism has been gaining power. Some commentators have likened that environment to a brewing civil war. The civil war metaphor can be valuable in the sense that it illustrates the passion behind the words. We're willing to fight and die for our symbols, our beliefs, and the rhetoric is an integral aspect of our struggle. It's akin to warfare, to battles, destruction, victories. Everyone's ready to fight. Yet contemporary rhetorician Kenneth Burke, in A Rhetoric of Motive, argues that such warfare, symbolic or of any kind, isn't the solution to our problems. It's the root cause of it. Burke argues that the most serious problem a person ever faces is warfare, and by that he means the alienation or separation from the community. Rhetoric typically creates that sense of alienation, and Burke states it is the only solution for it. There is no prescription for consensus or regulation, only empathy, tolerance, and the willingness to swap symbols until the sentiments align. As Burke wrote, you persuade a man only insofar as you can talk his language by speech, gesture, tonality, order, image, attitude, idea, identifying your ways with his. Scholar Lloyd Bitzer labeled this Burkean approach to connecting with an audience identification, and he said the process inherently was natural and ongoing, in which people experience a constant condition of both division and community in the attempt to find common meaning, unifying symbols, and ways of acting together, and thus promoting cooperation, even if it is ephemeral. These fleeting connections are possible, Burke wrote, because of the underlying framework of symbols and symbol use that we share. He called this intrinsic human quality consubstantiality, or as James Herricks described it in The History and Theory of Rhetoric, the commonality of substance, or the base substances that compose all of humanity. Those are physical embodiment, common aspirations, and the use of language itself, like air, water, food. We simultaneously can think of Burke's idea of symbolic action, then, as the plugging and unplugging of words or symbols together in an attempt to find patterns that align with the interpretations of other symbol users to form a union, as temporary as that might be. As Burke's contemporary Chaim Perelman put it in The New Rhetoric, rhetoric is a continuous adaptation of a speaker to an audience. Hence, as we see here in Obama's response to the midterm national elections earlier this month, reconnections, connections, reconnections are constantly being made.
Is that no one party will be able to dictate where we go from here, that we must find common ground in order to set, in order to make progress on some uncommonly difficult challenges. And I told John Boehner and Mitch McConnell last night, I am very eager to sit down with members of both parties and figure out how we can move forward together. I'm not suggesting this will be easy. I won't pretend that we will be able to bridge every difference or solve every disagreement. There's a reason we have two parties in this country, and both Democrats and Republicans have certain beliefs and certain principles that each feels cannot be compromised. But what I think the American people are expecting, and what we owe them, is to focus on those issues that affect their jobs, their security, and their future. Reducing our deficit, promoting a clean energy economy, making sure that our children are the best educated in the world, making sure that we're making the investments in technology that will allow us to keep our competitive edge in the global economy.
So Obama is putting out a list of topics in which he's stating that these are still in play. Increasing jobs, improving security, reducing our deficit, promoting clean energy, improving education, developing ways to remain competitive in the global economy. It's not as if these are new and groundbreaking topics. These are suggestions that Aristotle might call endoxa. But this act of presentation by Obama and this continuous adaptation is part of what Perelman considers a commune, as the rhetor and the audience engage in a symbol-swapping tango of identification. Politics involves power, but it also involves argument, teaching, and learning. There are important parallels, I think, with the inherent rhetorical tension that exists between students and instructors. The instructor must exhibit authority, or a high ethos, as Aristotle would call it, or would lack credibility. But that person also can be a world-renowned expert in a field and still not be a great teacher. The identification with students, the adjustments of the message to the audience, the connections made between them, creates the change or learning, just as it does in a political situation or any other of many environments. This is not a new revelation or extension, just a powerful one to recognize in broader terms of transcending fields of interest in politics, education, science, mathematics, whatever. These ideas may be very clearly evident in politics, particularly the way we dissect and analyze every move. But these ideas are much more broad and wide sweeping in importance and scope than they might appear to be in first glance. Let's expand a bit on the teaching metaphor. Think about what students are, if not an audience. Anyone who has had a detached or arrogant type of teacher can understand what I'm saying when I point out that just knowing the information and delivering it does not equate to great teaching. Cicero of ancient Rome was just one in a line of philosophers and statesmen to understand the value of not only knowing your audience, but also adapting to it. He wrote in De Orator in 55 BC, "Whereas in all other arts, that is most excellent which is farthest removed from the understanding and mental capacity of the untrained, in oratory, the very cardinal sin is to depart from the language of everyday life and the usage approved by the sense of the community." I think about how often I've used jargon or complex terms that students aren't ready for, and just seeing the blank looks on their faces, and had to take a step back and make that connection and then move forward. Oftentimes, I suppose, it's not even apparent that I'm doing this. I'm just going right over their heads. And these well-thought-out arguments, I think, are so wonderfully informative and thought-provoking, actually are just vaporous, floating through the air and never reaching their intended target. About 300 years before Cicero, Aristotle wrote about a term, enthymeme, in his work Rhetoric. He considered the enthymeme as one of the two ways to make an argument, the other being the use of examples, although he noted that enthymemes excite the louder applause. An enthymeme is sort of like a syllogism, he wrote, based on probabilities and signs, with probabilities being the typical outcomes of similar situations and signs being particulars drawn from the community knowledge base. Without an enthymeme, without connecting with the audience, Aristotle argued, rhetoric will not be effective. Politicians won't get elected, students won't learn. But the art of rhetoric involves creating that connection without giving up full control to the audience either, and telling them everything they want to hear, regardless of truth or importance. Obama could say that soon everyone in the United States will have a well-paying job with plenty of time off for family and vacations, and an end will come to all wars, and the sun will be shining from 9 to 9 daily, followed by a brief rainstorm to make the flowers grow. A teacher could say to a class that the curriculum will involve learning whatever the student wants to learn about, regardless of relevance to a particular topic, and that everyone will get an A, and every assessment will be glowing, and credit will be given, regardless of attendance or effort. Going overboard with audience appeals is the sort of approach that infuriated Plato, and one that provoked his ire at the sophists and Gorgias. So by talking about audience, I want to make clear that simply pandering to a crowd is not the same as making a communion. Perelman suggested that the speaker display certain elements that should be brought to the audience's attention in order to make the connection. Plato thought that the universal truth would rise to the surface independent of audience. But even his top student, Aristotle, realized that audience appeals or pathos is a fundamental part of rhetoric. It is a basic element, a core substance, along with ethos and logos. Only with pathos could America have e pluribus unum, out of many, one. Only with pathos can politicians get elected. Only with pathos can students learn. Whether through politics or a formal classroom or wherever, we are all learning together all the time. We are creating the next generation of Americans together, trying to find happiness in our place in the world, breathing the same air, drinking the same water, eating the same foods. This is a joint operation among us all. We share this place. We share many of the same ideas. We all want a better world. Let our rhetoric reflect that.